Where's this great sign?
Today's agenda for the subcommittee is our initial review of three different measures related to the sanity defense in Oregon. And as noted on the agenda previously issued by the committee, it is not our intention today to take general public testimony. We're going to spend the day getting ourselves oriented on what is in the bill, what the perception of the problem is of the different things. What the problem is as perceived by the proponents of the different bills. I'd like to begin by asking our staff to give us an overview she's been preparing on the present law and how it is operating as being administered.
Mr. Chair and committee members, what I will give is a fairly brief overview of what the existing law provides as far as the present defense of not responsible due to mental disease or defect up to the point of persons when they are committed to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Under existing law, a person is not responsible for criminal conduct at the time of the conduct and as a result of mental disease or defect. The person lacks substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality of the act or to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. This is what is known as the Model Penal Code ALI test for insanity. It excludes also abnormalities that are manifested solely by repeated criminal acts or otherwise antisocial behavior. Evidence of mental disease or defect also is admissible when it's relevant to the issue of whether the person had the intent, which is an element of the crime, whether used to exclude responsibility or partial responsibility, going to the issue of intent, mental disease, or defect, is an affirmative defense, meaning that if it's raised as a defense at trial, the defendant has the burden of proving the defense by a preponderance of the evidence. In order to introduce evidence of this defense at trial, the defendant has to provide written notice of their intent to use this defense at the time that they of their pleading of not guilty. Exceptions to this may be made by the court for just cause, however. When such notice is filed, the state then has the right to have the defendant examined by at least one psychiatrist or a psychologist of its choosing. Also, the court has the discretion to order the person committed to a state institution or another facility for observation and examination for up to 30 days. When the defendant is found not responsible, this must be stated in the judgment and in the verdict and judgment. Once a not responsible judgment has been made, the court, on the basis of the information from the trial or additional information that may be obtained at another hearing, if requested, can make one of two orders. First of all, if they find that the person no longer is affected by mental disease or defect, or if so affected, no longer presents a substantial danger to others and isn't in need of continuing care, treatment, or supervision, then it orders the person discharged from custody. If, however, the court finds by a preponderance of evidence that the person is affected by mental disease or defect and presents a substantial danger to others requiring commitment to the state hospital or placement on conditional release, and if the person would have been convicted of either a felony or of a misdemeanor involving physical injury or a risk of physical injury to persons, then the court orders the person placed under the jurisdiction of the PSRB for care and treatment. In these cases, the court makes a finding on the record of what offense the defendant would have been convicted of if found responsible, and whether there's a victim of that crime, and whether the victim wants to be notified of things that are going to, of other proceedings involving that person later on. If a person is placed under the board's jurisdiction, it is for a period equal to the maximum sentence that the person could have received if the person had been found responsible. An order of the court placing the person under the PSRB's jurisdiction is appealable, and the person is entitled to appointed counsel if indigent. The other group of persons found not responsible and subject to different disposition are those who, if they'd been responsible, would have been found guilty of a misdemeanor where there was no physical injury or risk of physical injury involved. And if, in this case, if the court finds that the person is affected by mental disease or defect and presents a substantial danger to others requiring either commitment or a conditional release, then the court can proceed with such a person as under the civil commitment procedures, except that the applicable standard of proof is a preponderance of evidence. At this point, if the committee wants to go back to the person who is committed to the jurisdiction of the PSRB, Felicia Greenwash, who's executive director of the board, is here and able to sort of walk the committee through a case history of a person who has been committed to the board.
Let's do that, Felicia, before we start our consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Felicia Greenwash, and I've been executive director since November of last year. I prepared some material, and Linda asked me if I would be ready to present to you a typical sort of hearing and some of the information. I have an introduction for you, and in a lot of material, there's no material that takes any position on the bills at this time, but it gives you some of the background information and a lot of statistics that have been put together by the board and by Jeffrey Rogers, who is here in the audience, a former chairman of the board. Also, at the bottom of your packet, what I'm going to do is go through a typical hearing. And so I put together a sample file that will give you, I think, a very good idea of the process. First of all, if you open that up, what I am going to do is go through the file, and that will tell you the different processes that we have, because this is a hearing that goes through somebody that was committed to the board was committed by the judge prior to 1978. The board came into existence in 1978, and all of the cases that persons had been found guilty were at that time put under the board's jurisdiction. One of the important things to point out to show the need for somebody doing better monitoring is that it took a few years to even find out which cases the judges had. In other words, we still are now at this time finding out about cases where the judge has placed somebody on conditional release and hasn't sent us the file, and we sometimes have a hard time locating those people. And there is a group of people, maybe 10, maybe 20, we don't know how many, that we never have been able to locate, and some files that we never got from the courts because they couldn't locate them. But hopefully we have most of the cases at this time. In this case, in October of 76, the court on a burglary sentenced this person to the Oregon State Hospital, and the person was found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. That's pre-board's existence. And then there, you'll see in number two, what's numbered number two, there was a psychological evaluation. I only put one in here. There was actually several of them. And the trial order of the court. Whenever we get a file, we get the actual order of the court because we need to know what the crime was, because that tells us how long we have jurisdiction. Again, as your counsel told you, we have jurisdiction over the maximum period of time. So we have people for 1 year. About 20% of our cases are misdemeanor crimes, and a lot of those people serve under our jurisdiction for the full amount of time. Other crimes, we have 5, 10, 20, or life. Now, statistics of this time, whenever we give you statistics or other people give you statistics, I think it's important to keep in mind that it's difficult to give you a clear amount of statistics because we've only been in existence for 5 years. So the people that we have for 20 years or for life, we don't know how long they're going to be staying at the hospital. Some of those people are going to be there probably forever or under our jurisdiction for their life or for 20 years, which is obviously much longer than they would be in the correction system. In this case, when the board got jurisdiction over this person, there was a recommendation from the senior psychiatrist at the hospital that recommended the person be placed on conditional release. And the order of the board, which is noted as number 5, then was a hearing before the board. A typical hearing is we have 3 members of the board appear. The hearings of patients that are at the hospital are done at the hospital. You'll have the 3 members of the board and a staff person taping the hearing. Then you'll have the patient there, in almost all cases, unless the patient absolutely refuses to come to the hearing. And some mandatory hearings we have to hold even if the patient isn't there. We have an attorney representing the patient, and almost all cases are appointed attorneys. And now that we have the statewide system, they're appointed by the state, and we have a group of attorneys that have meet certain qualifications that we appoint to represent the patient. And then you'll have the testimony. The psychiatrist will be there, the psychiatrist that is seeing the patient will be there to testify, and sometimes the social worker. We also, by law, have to give notice to the victim, so sometimes the victim might be there or a member of the family. Usually, though, the typical hearing, you'll only have the attorney and the patient and the doctor testifying at that point. The district attorney can also appear, and as of July, the attorney general will be handling those cases. We rarely have a district attorney appear on behalf of the state, so it's the members of the board that ask all of the questions that are needed to make the legal decisions. In this hearing, there were 3 members of the board, and they made a finding based upon the law that the person did have a mental disease or defect and that the person was dangerous to self or other. In 1981, we took out to self, so now we only have jurisdiction if the person has a mental disease or defect and is a danger to other people, substantial danger. So we have the order of the court in this case. And then what happened was the person was out in Clackamas County on conditional release in the community. And there was an order of revocation. And when we issue an order of revocation, what happens is we keep in very close contact with the people that are monitoring that person. When we place somebody out, we will say where they're going to live, what kind of mental health treatment they're going to get, who's going to supervise them, and we demand at least monthly reports. Sometimes we'll ask for weekly reports. It depends on how the patient is doing and how much monitoring they need. And then we might also put in the order that they can't drink, they can't drive, they have to take antabuse to make sure they're not drinking, they might have to come in to take urine tests to check whether they're taking drugs, if drugs seems to be their problem. We'll monitor the situation, we'll put in the order what it is that the problem with that patient is, and when we put them in the community, we try to put as much in the order to keep track and try to keep the person out of trouble. In this case, in exhibit, as I marked, exhibit number 6, there was an order of revocation. And what happened was we draft up an affidavit and the staff started hearing that there were problems with that patient in the community. And basically the problem was, in this case, that the patient was ordered to reside with his father, and the patient was ordered to keep typically all the rules and regulations, but in this case was not keeping his mental health appointments. So we revoked him. Typically we'll revoke someone. What happens when we revoke him, the order is signed by the board, by the chairman or another member of the board, and it goes into the state police computer, and basically it's like a warrant. Any peace officer of the state is ordered to pick that person up and take him back to the state hospital, to the forensic unit. So that's what occurred in this place. And the board then has a revocation hearing, another mandatory hearing. We have to hold a hearing within 20 days when somebody is revoked from the community and placed back to the hospital, and we hold a hearing and decide, does that person have to stay in the hospital because they're too dangerous to be let out, or we don't have the facility to put them in the community? Or are they ready to be placed out in the community, and do we have the available resources? There are a group of people that are in the hospital that the board has already decided typically that they're ready to be placed in the community, but we don't have the facilities. For example, the board might say they'll be ready to go if we can find a group home or some kind of supervised living situation. And supervised living is the biggest problem we have with many kind of patients, but certainly mental patients. And so we won't release them in the community because we don't have the right place to put them. So in this case, the board ordered that the person be committed to the hospital. His mental status had changed and they felt he needed to stay in. Then in Exhibit 8, there was an application for a hearing. This was an application by the patient, and there was a summary of a conditional release plan that was put together by the social workers of that patient. There was also a number 9 is a Providence Hospital evaluation. We have in the 3 main counties, the biggest counties where we have patients in Multnomah County, Marion County, and Lane County, a contract with usually the local mental health. In Portland, it's with Providence Hospital. We have a contract to have 25-30 of our patients. As you'll see, exhibit number 9 is very long, and it goes through a very complete evaluation where they have not only a psychological, but also they have a group. I think they have usually around 8 people that are sitting in and when they do the evaluation. So they do a very extensive evaluation. And at the end of that evaluation, they recommended that if the person was put in a structured living situation, received vocational testing and training, that his medication be monitored, and a lot of our patients do need medication monitoring, that he obtain some sort of employment, and that he be involved in the Providence Hospital day treatment. The people we put in Multnomah County that are with the Providence program typically will come in anywhere from a couple of days to 5 or 6 days a week to treatment, and they have different groups and services, and it's a very comprehensive program that they have. So in this case, they said that this person would be acceptable for their program. The board then had their hearing, and they did order him conditionally released to the Providence program to be living at a group home. Supervision, in addition to Providence, was going to be by a probation officer. Then you'll see in Exhibit 11, there's monthly reports that we got. And if you read through those, it'll show different problems that are coming up with this patient. There's stress in the different, with the person that was having with his schooling, and eventually I think he quit going to school. The social worker that was doing the reports was saying that there was a real need to keep a structure and that the person has something to do on a day-to-day basis. He was taking welding classes at that time. You'll also note that they talk about problems he was having with the girlfriend and the family. That's very important, and in fact, a lot of times when we have somebody in the community, the social worker, whoever is monitoring them, do involve the family and the living situation or the girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, because that's important, because one of the reasons we'll revoke someone is because their mental health has changed, and the best person to know that is the person that's closest to them. And so it is very important to have that sort of feedback. It depends on the patient as to how much we involve other people in their life. In this case, you'll see that part of the problem that this patient was having in the regular progress reports were problems he was having with his family and with his girlfriend. Then finally, in the last progress report we got in January of 81, it showed that there really was, that he was starting to hallucinate at one time. At one point, he was up all night at the group home and he was yelling and screaming, and when the social worker came to see him, he refused to leave the room. There was no indication that he was going to do anything dangerous. His crime was a burglary, but at that point, certainly his mental health status had changed, and so the board revoked him. He was returned back to the hospital, and in the affidavit that's in Exhibit 12, it says that the reason to revoke him was because of the failure to communicate, that he wasn't able to communicate. He appeared to be having hallucinations. He was uncommunicative and extremely suspicious, as well as the fact that he was missing his appointments with the mental health people. The board then ordered him committed after having another revocation hearing within 20 days. And then there was again an evaluation done by Providence, and they said, yes, we'll take him back again. There was an application for a hearing. Again, the same conditional release plan was worked out with him going back. And he was sent back, ordered conditionally released to Providence to reside at another group home in February of 82. Then we got progress reports for a full year, almost a full year, from February of 82 to January of 83, and those are in Exhibit 17. And they show that he was doing relatively well, but not for a while, and then he seemed to be doing worse. And finally, again, he was revoked because he was failing to keep his appointments with the people, with the mental health people. And the board then did revoke him, and he's back in the hospital, and the last thing you see is, again, a third report from Providence saying he's going to, they would be willing to take him back, and we'll see what happens. It is very typical that we have people coming in and out of the hospital, in and out from conditional release. And when we revoke someone from conditional release, sometimes, obviously, it's for a crime that they've committed. That's obviously a reason we put them right back in. But the majority of reasons that we revoke someone is because we're in contact with the people, and they start, either somebody in the home or the mental health person, the social worker, or somebody in their residence, and they start saying that the person's having problems. Or they're not showing up for their appointments, they're not taking their medication, or somebody saw them drinking, or there's a suspicion that they were walking around with a gun. Whatever it is, whether it's proven or not, we have to have some sort of basis to put in the into the affidavit that goes with the revocation. But depending on how well that patient's doing, we might revoke them for merely not showing up at their residence at night and staying out all night. That, for some patients, is enough. For other patients, you might not be as worried if they're doing very well. So this is a typical sort of case where somebody is in and out. There are other people that go out on conditional release that do very well in the community, and we don't need to revoke them at all. Those are the people that then start applying to be discharged. And the board would have a discharge hearing. We have certain mandatory hearings that we have to have. The initial hearing has to be within 20 days. A patient can request a hearing every 6 months, and we have some patients that request them every time for either to be on conditional release or to be discharged, and they're either given it or not given it, and then they can request it again. I do have some statistics for you just briefly on your introduction sheet. Since the existence of the board, we have had about 640 people. I put approximately in each of them because, again, there are some cases that we're just finding out with people being that are under our jurisdiction that we are just catching up. There's not very many of those. Of the present population that we have now, there's about 300. The reason for the others is either their time ran out, our jurisdiction lapsed, or they were discharged by the board. Okay, of the present population, which there's about 300 people under our jurisdiction, we have about 150 in the state hospital. That's mostly at the Oregon State Hospital. It's about 130, 145 there. Then we have about 100, just over 100, 105 people on conditional release in Oregon, about 25 people on conditional release outside of Oregon. We do, as you see, that's quite a few of them, but there are some people that have family and support groups outside of the state that if the board feels they're doing well enough, then it might be very appropriate to send them back to their family or their mental health situation, somebody that has some sort of background about that, but especially somebody that's just traveling through Oregon from California, going, heading up, and they commit a crime here, but they're really, their whole base of support is in the other state. So we will sometimes allow them to go to the other state. Then the difference of those that makes up the 300, we have about six people that are on unauthorized leave from the hospital. We have about 10 people on revocation status now that were on conditional release and we've revoked them and we haven't gotten them back yet. And we have about four people in the correction system. There are people that have both been found not responsible for one crime and maybe have committed, another crime and are found guilty of that crime and are serving time in the penitentiary. So there's often a mix between our jurisdiction and other court's jurisdiction. I also would like to point out in the different material, there's some very recent things that have been going on. First of all, the American Psychiatric Association did an extensive research project on the insanity defense and came out with a report in, I believe it was actually in December of 82, and in their report they go through the history of the insanity defense, and at the end of it they say that the American Psychiatric Association believes the decision to release
what they call insanity acuities should not be made solely by psychiatrist or solely on the basis of psychiatric testimony about the person's mental condition or predictions about future dangerousness. While this may not be the only model, such decisions should be made by a group similar in composition to a parole board. The American Psychiatric Association is impressed with the model program presently in operation in the state of Oregon under the auspices of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And then they go on to say that it's a multidisciplinary board, that we retain jurisdiction for as long as the criminal sentence might have been, and that confinement and release decisions are made by an experienced body that is not naive about the nature of violent behavior committed by mental patients. And that allows a quasi-criminal approach to managing such persons. The psychiatrists work, participate in the work of the board, but they don't make the decision. And so that's a very recent recommendation that was made. The board in my office has been receiving a lot of calls recently about our system, and it is being noted nationwide. NBC just came out 2 months ago and taped some hearings and are doing the research for one of those white paper specials that they do on psychiatry and the law. It was to be scheduled in March, and it's now been rescheduled for April 26. And in it, apparently from the filming that they did, they're looking at use of psychiatry in general in the law, and they are using the Oregon system as a model system in their program. We'll see it in April. Also, there's a lot of other, I've been very recently just been getting a lot of contacts. New Hampshire has a bill in to start up a psychiatric security review board. A representative called just this week and has a bill in and wanted some more information. So there's a lot of interest in our system. And at this point, I guess I'd like to just see if you have any questions. As I said, I'm not taking any position, and the board has taken some position on the bills, but I understand this hearing is more to give you information, and at a later time we'll have positions on different portions of the bills.
Well, I answered the first question I was going to ask was, will the board be prepared to provide the committee with its reaction to the different bills?
Yes, we've already done that preliminarily, and I just haven't done that at this hearing.
Right. I would prefer if the committee would not mind to hold off getting them back just now. Use this just as an occasion to clarify our understanding of how the board is presently operating. Are there any questions of Felicia? We appreciate the thoroughness of this presentation, Felicia. Been helpful. I'm sure we'll be returning to it more than once before we're through.
There's a lot of material there, and it'll take you a while to go through it.
Thank you for taking the time to organize the board. Okay, our hearing on the bills 27-5, Representative Courtney.
Mr. Chair, can I just sort of go through quickly what materials the committee has before it?
Sure.
There are some budget management fiscal statements on each of the bills, 2075, 2269, 2892. There is some testimony from the board, or written testimony from the Board of Parole, regarding their concerns with these three measures. There's an article called The Insanity Defense on Trial from the Harvard Law School Bulletin, and a number of newspaper clippings were distributed to you before. At this time, I'm going to distribute to you a hand-engrossed copy of House Bill 2075. It has in it the LC amendments, House Bill 2075-1, dated February 21st, 1983. Those are the amendments that Representative Courtney has had prepared. And also, you should have received a copy of those, of the LC amendments themselves some time ago. Also distributing some testimony that was provided by Representative Courtney. Is that correct, Representative
Courtney? Correct, right. Representative Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Courtney, State Representative District 33. The testimony that I prepared for you is in layperson's language, and it's in somewhat shorthand fashion, and maybe I'm reacting to having dealt with this subject for months during the interim, but usually the documents that deal on this subject are so heavy and so intricate that it's important for at least my type of person to reduce them to layperson's language, if no other reason for my own understanding. So I hope that I haven't insulted anyone's intelligence for writing in this fashion. Representative Lombard, Representative Springer will probably remember the fact that there was a day, I don't remember the day, in the House Judiciary Committee in 1981 in which we had some bills which touched on the mental state or the insanity state, if you will, of the defendant. And we decided at that time, rather than try to recreate the rule, if that need be, in the insanity plea, that we would go into the interim and look at the whole area and find out whether or not we needed to make any changes at all. At that time, Representative Tom Mason was heading up the Judiciary Committee, and he called me after the session ended and asked if I would head off the interim committee study. And so we got underway, and I well remember the first day of the hearing, public hearing on the insanity plea, because we had defense attorney against defense attorney, seemingly prosecutor against prosecutor, and psychiatrist against psychiatrist. And I came away with the impression that really it was just too difficult a subject to even mess with, because I think at the time the deal idea was maybe we should try to abolish the insanity plea. Subsequently, we were able to put together a group of people who represented prosecutors, judges, psychiatrists, the PSRB, the Attorney General's Office, defense attorneys, and through several public hearings, came up with some ideas which the interim committee were willing to put in a pre-session, in a bill 2075, and have a pre-session filed. Now, I want to be sure to note for the members of the committee here that no